Okay, good. Thank you.
Last moment.
So my talk will follow a handout. I hope you all have a copy. Maybe I should say that sort of the top two pages are the front page, and you may want to do something immoral and just take the two apart, because I'm going to switch between the sort of pages 1, 2 and pages 3, 4 very often. Also, I should say that back when I was here last time, which was in February 2003, Professor Lev Rozanski told me some things which may or may not be exactly what I talk about today, except I don't remember. So Lev, please tell me at the end of the talk if you knew all of that 15 years ago. Okay? Now, maybe a bit of an introduction. So I'll be talking about Gauss diagram formulas, and let me tell you what the spirit is. So there's something called finite type invariants of knots, and finite type invariants of knots are defined by, so these are invariants whose, so such invariants are of degree D if their D plus first derivative is equal to zero, in some sense. Like polynomials whose D plus first derivative are equal to zero, well, that's a polynomial of degree D. But then Gauss diagram formulas, or the Gusarov-Polyakov theorem, says that such invariants come from formulas which look as follows. So you kind of sum over all possibilities of looking at exactly D places in the knot, and mostly forgetting everything else. Of everything else, you remember only the skeleton, but not the actual crossing information. So you sum over all possibilities of looking at just D places in the knot, and computing something out of these D places. So this is sort of like saying that a polynomial of degree D is a sum of products of monomials, or of things that depend on only one coordinate, and you take D of them. Okay? So it's the analog of the distinction between the kind of different definition or characterization of polynomials as things whose D plus first derivative is equal to zero, and the construction of polynomials as products of coordinate functions. Okay? Anyway, if you look at this, but that's not really what I want to talk about. I mean, if you look at this Gusarov-Polyakov or Gauss diagram formulas, it's completely obvious that Gauss diagram formulas are polynomial time computable, right? Because in degree D, you look at all subsets of D crossings of the knot. There are n choose D of them. That's roughly like n to the power D. That's a polynomial in n of degree D. And that's it. And then you do something trivial for each of these summons. So basically, it's a polynomial time computable in degree D. Now, there are finitely many finite type invariants of degree D. And if you look at this theorem, it's almost tempting to conjecture that anything that is computable in polynomial time in knot theory should come from a Gusarov-Polyakov formula, from a Gauss diagram formula, and therefore from a finite type invariant. Because, I mean, if you have polynomial time, if you have n to the d units of time, what can you do? You can only look at d crossings each time, right? And you so basically, what else can you do? So it's almost tempting to think that's a theorem, that every polynomial time computable invariant of knots should be computable in should be a finite type invariant coming from a Gusarov-Polyakov theorem. From a Gauss diagram formula. Unfortunately, this is fortunately, this is complete nonsense. Because there is the Alexander polynomial, which comes, which is computed in a different way. And so the situation looks a little bit like an anomaly. So in the, if you want polynomial time computable invariants of naught, then in time proportional to n, you can do only one thing, and that's the Rith, or the self-linking number. In time computable proportional to n squared, there is V2, the degree 2 Vassiliev invariant. In time proportional to n cubed, there is V3, the degree 3 Vassiliev invariant. In time computable proportional to n4, there are infinitely many invariants, all the coefficients of the Alexander polynomial. And then back again, it's a small number of invariants for each polynomial degree. Now, that looks like a completely unreasonable picture. Why would it be that sort of new polynomial, not polynomial, will stop arising at a certain complexity, at complexity n to the 4 or so? It just looks completely unreasonable. So there must be more. So there must be some polynomial time computable invariant, polynomial invariant of knots. When I say polynomial, I just mean infinitely many scalars. Okay? So there must be some way to get in polynomial time much more information about knots than we currently have. And the fact that we're not getting it yet is sort of ridiculous. So what are we doing comparing totally uncomputable things like I will not name anything. But what are we doing comparing or working on things which are completely uncomputable, when there has to be computable things right under our noses, we must find them. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about them, and I should also say that everything that I will say today will be along with an implementation. So here's the first. So it will be along with a session demonstrating the implementation. So the first bit of the session, and let me just start it by running it. Click. So is to load just a database of existing knots, and that's basically all that there is in this first bit of session. And let me also say that I will be talking about a quick invariant of large knots today, but the bigger picture is to talk about quilts, so quick invariants of large tangles, which would be even more interesting. And I very, very just want to sketch why. So basically, if you understand invariants of, if you understand tangles well, then using tangles and various operations between them, you can describe certain classes of knots. So for example, you can describe ribbon knots as tangles that satisfy certain, using tangles that satisfy certain equations written in the world of tangles. So the moment you have a computable invariant of tangles or computable invariant of large tangles, it gives you a handle on trying to prove that certain knots are a ribbon or not ribbon. And there are open problems about that, which are very interesting in themselves. And sort of the first potential counterexamples require computations that involve pretty large knots. So 48 crossings in this case. So that's my other motivation for wishing to have polynomial time computable invariants of knots, which also extend to tangles in a well-behaved way. And this is only a sketch, so I'll move on to what I really to what I want to talk about today, which is quilk. So quick invariants of large knots. And any comments, questions? Sorry, I'm sort of a bit confused myself right now, so you must be even more. Okay. So maybe a bit of a reminder about Gauss diagrams. So a Gauss diagram is a little diagram that encodes all the information in a knot, and it's constructed as follows. So if you have a long knot, so this is a long knot diagram of the figure 8 knot, then what you do is you go along the knot, and every time you go through a crossing, you put a number. So you put 1 on the first crossing, you put 2 on the second crossing, then 3 on the third crossing, then 4 the second time you go through the first crossing, then 5, 6, 7, and 8. And then you make a line with the numbers 1 through 8 on it. And on this line, you indicate the crossings by connecting them with arrows. So there is a crossing between 1 and 4, so you make an arrow from 1 to 4, and it's from 1 to 4 because 1 is over 4. And then there is an arrow here from 7 to 2, which must correspond to a crossing in which 7 goes over 2. And finally, each crossing has a sign, so correspondingly, I indicate each arrow with a little sign. So the arrow from 1 to 4 has a plus next to it because this is a positive crossing, and so on. So this way, there is a correspondence between Gauss diagrams and long knots, or long knot diagrams. I promise that everything will go along with an implementation, so here is an implementation of this bit. So first of all, I define that the Gauss diagram of a link is defined by, well, first of all, you take the built-in information of the link, which comes from this package knot theory, and every place you find a crossing, if it's a positive crossing, you turn it to an arrow positive from L to I, and if it's a negative crossing, you turn it into an arrow minus from J to I. And again, to explain what these things are, you need to know what are the conventions used by the package that I've just loaded, and I don't want to tell you, but I only want to emphasize that it's simple and easy. Okay? And then secondly, here is the program that draws a Gauss diagram. So if I'm telling you to draw a Gauss diagram, what you do is you draw a line from coordinates 0, 0 to coordinates n plus 1, comma 0, and then for each of the arrows in the Gauss diagram G, you draw an arrow along a Bezier curve from certain coordinates to some other coordinates. Here's how it comes out. So here's the result of applying draw to the Gauss diagrams of all knots with 3 to 5 crossings. There are only 4 of them. And here is 3-1, here is 4-1, and here are the 2-5 crossing knots. And let's see what it corresponds to. So here are the Gauss diagrams of all knots with 3 to 5 crossings. So say 4-1 corresponds to this Gauss diagram. And I just want you to be familiar with the notation. So this is 4-1. There is a positive arrow from 1 to 4. So here it appears as AP, so arrow positive from 1 to 4. Arrow positive from 5 to 8 corresponds to this arrow, and so on. Okay? So I just want to emphasize that everything is easy and simple. Anyway, what's a Gauss diagram formula? So if G is a Gauss diagram, and F is a formula diagram. And what it is it's an unsigned Gauss diagram. So exactly the same as a Gauss diagram, except without the signs on the arrows. Then I define the GPV pairing of F with G to be the sum over all subdiagrams of G. So you look at all subdiagrams of G which have the same number of arrows as F. And for each subdiagram, you first of all compute the delta function of F with Y. So y bar is y with the signs removed. So first of all, you check if g is the same as y bar. If f is the same as y bar. If it is, you take 1, otherwise you take 0. And if it's 1, then you also multiply it by minus 1 by the sign of y. So basically by the product of all the signs that are appearing in y. So maybe I should give an example. So for the figure 8 knot, whose Gauss diagram has 4 arrows, you will be summing over all ways of marking and assuming the formula F is the formula given by this Gauss diagram, which has only two arrows, then the Gauss diagram formula will be you sum over all subdiagrams of G of size 2. So basically all, so you sum over all ways of marking two of the arrows in the original G with red, and then turning the other arrows to gray, which kind of means you don't look at them, they disappear. So you sum over all ways of marking two of them in red, and for each such pair that's marked in red, you compare it with this. If it's the same as this, in this case it is the same as this, you take it with a coefficient plus times minus, meaning with coefficient minus 1. If it's not the same as that, you take it with coefficient 0. So this is the Gauss pairing, so this is the GPV pairing of F with G. Maybe before showing the implementation, what it means at the level of the knot diagram is that you, so highlighting two of the crossing of the arrows corresponds to highlighting two of the crossings, and then you don't quite forget the rest. You turn it gray, but not transparent. You don't entirely forget it, because you still have to remember how things connect. So to you still have to remember that when you come out of the first crossing, you enter the second one at what place. Okay? So you still, you basically just retain the skeleton of the gray information. Anyway, here's the implementation. So first of all, CF takes a Gauss diagram and brings it to canonical form. So if there are gaps in the numberings, in the numbering, it removes the gaps. But sort of this is silly, you don't want to think about it. The more serious stuff is the GPV pairing of F with G. If the length of F is greater than the length of G, then G is not going to have any subdiagrams of size the same as the length of F, then it's zero. If the length of F is less than the length of G, then you sum over all Ys, which are subsets of G of size the length of F, and for each such subset, you just take the GPV pairing of F with this subset. And finally, if the length of F is the same as the length of G, then if the canonical form of F is the same as the canonical form of G after you identify positive and negative arrows to be just arrows, then if they are the same, then you take minus 1 to the number of negative arrows in G. Otherwise, you take 0. So this is precisely the GPV formula, the GPV pairing, okay? And finally, V2 of a diagram G is defined to be the GPV pairing of the Gauss diagram of G with, sorry, of G with the Gauss diagram A31, A24, which is exactly the Gauss diagram shown here. So with these definitions, here is a table for each knot with between 3 and 7 crossings. Here is V2 of that knot. For 3-1, it's 1. For 4-1, it's minus 1. We've already seen that, in fact. And here is what it is for the rest. Okay. So again, the underexplained theorem of Gusarov-Polyak-Virov states that every finite type invariant arises in this way. What do I mean by underexplained? So what I mean is that there is the original proof in the original paper. There is no other proof anywhere else, in as much as I know, except for copying.
No, there is a proof by Vasiliev.
Maybe. Okay.
100 pages.
Okay, so that overexplained is a form of underexplained.
Yes. this just with his spectral sequence.
Okay, so in reality, it's a very, very fundamental theorem. If you want to understand it, there is no kind of canonical, natural, simple-minded proof, simple proof that sort of in which every step is clearly a conceptual consequence of the previous one. So somebody should explain it correctly. Oleg, do you agree?
Yeah, I don't mind.
Okay. Anyway, here's another example. So let F3 be this degree 3 Gauss diagram times 3 plus twice this degree 3 Gauss diagram plus all possible rotations thereof. So they are written as linear diagrams, but I really mean sort of write them along a circle and look at all possible ways of rotating them. And then the claim is that the pairing of F3 with any node K will give you six times the standard Vasiliev degree 3 invariant of this node K. So again, this is in accordance with the GPV theorem. So if you want a formula for V3 using Gauss diagrams, here it is. And again, here is the implementation. First of all, I have to extend the GPV pairing to be linear. So I define it so that if the left-hand side has a sum in it, then you get the sum, likewise for multiplication by a scalar. Secondly, I have to define what it means to rotate a Gauss diagram k units to the left. So basically, every integer that appears in it should be replaced by this integer minus k, taken modulo the length of the diagram, so that negative numbers become big numbers once again. That's rotation. And then F3 is sum as k goes from 0 to 5 of rotation k times of this Gauss diagram plus rotation k times of that Gauss diagram. These are exactly the two Gauss diagrams shown in the previous slide. And V3 of a node K is the pairing of F3 with this with the Gauss diagram of the node K, all of this divided by 6. That's exactly an implementation of the formula I mentioned before. So here is a table of V3 computed for all nodes with up to 7 crossings. Well, these are just numbers, it's not too much fun. What's more fun is to compute a histogram of the values of V2 versus V3. And I'm doing it really only for fun, because the answer, if you look at it from above, looks a little bit like a fish. If you look at this picture from above, it looks like a fish, and it's the Willerton fish, and I don't think anybody fully explained why. Okay? So Willerton saw the fish, and I've turned it into a histogram, and now you can see that it looks like the downtown of some city. Okay. Anyway, but that's only for fun. That explains somehow the discrete finite type invariants, the finitely many ones that you can get in every computational complexity. How would you get more? Okay? So this is somehow the key. So if you want more, what you should do is my proposal for how to get more is you should increase your environmental awareness a little bit more. So instead of marking 2 of the crossings or 3 of the crossings in red and concentrating on them and essentially forgetting the rest, so turning them into gray, don't quite forget them, but just don't quite turn them into gray, but turn them into pink. So look at them, but look at them in a coarser way. Look at them while retaining less information. Okay? So not just the skeleton, not the full thing, but some relatively mild and easily computable invariant of the pink stuff. So a Gauss-Gessner formula for a Gauss diagram G would be a sum over all subdiagrams of G whose size is at most K. K will be 1 or 2 or 3, so small number. And for each such subdiagram Y of size K, you will be computing some function f of y, Y is a very finite amount of information. It's just three arrows. So basically, the information in these three arrows. Okay? That's very finite amount of information. And so this function f can also depend on some invariant z of the complement of y, so the pink stuff, okay, where z is the Gassner invariant of the complement. So I should explain what the Gassner invariant of the complement is, and I will in a minute. Let me just tell you, before explaining what it is, let me explain to you that it's an invariant of tangles, or more precisely, virtual tangles, and it has values in matrices whose dimension is equal to the number of components of the tangle. Okay? So, a different way to look at YC, so a different way to look at the complement of a Gauss diagram, of a subdiagram, is to say that you take your original knot diagram, you mark Y on it, so you mark two crossings, and you remove them. Now, if you remove two crossings from a knot diagram, what is left is a tangle in a punctured disk. Right? So, in fact, I think I more or less had a picture of this before. So, right here. So, oops, no. It was too far ago, too long ago before, sorry. So if you remove the two red things from a knot diagram, what is left is a tangle written here in gray in the complement of a disk, in a disk minus two smaller disks, right? So the Gassner, now I have to go back to this, good. So the Gassner invariant is an invariant of such tangles. Now, technically, it's a little bit easier to write it in a slightly different way. So instead of, I wish I had access to a board space. Let me say it in more, no. So basically, instead of, so you know what, I'll say it on the diagram. So instead of thinking of Y complement as being the diagram with red removed, I'll think of Y complement as being the diagram with red removed and then placed back again, but with the cuts preserved. So basically, instead of removing two crossings, just cut the diagram near. No, this is awful. Sorry. Then
you can turn one projector off and erase the screen.
Yeah. So basically, instead of removing a crossing, which would create a gap, I will, excellent. Well, instead of removing a crossing which would create a gap in the diagram, I will remove it and then reinsert it, and then I just have two cuts in the diagram, in the projection. So I still have a tangle in the complement of a few disks, but I've just reinserted the crossings back into the disk. And it's only for a completely technical reason that I do it. And of course, okay. So, can you lower it again? Sorry, okay. So, but now I have to tell you how to compute an invariant of tangles and with values in matrices, and or how to compute the Burau-Gassner invariant of tangles, and think of a tangle as being this picture, but equally well it could have been a virtual tangle or a tangle in a disk minus a few, in a Swiss cheese disk, so a disk minus a few smaller disks. Anyway, there are two operations that I want you to consider on such tangles. So first of all, if you have two such tangles, you can take their disjoint union, which is to place the two of them side by side. And the other operation is if you have one such tangle, T, and it has two strands labeled A and B, you can stitch together, and this is the operation MAB sub C, you can stitch together the end of A to the tail of B, and the result, well, it will be MABC of T, and well, the result looks like this. You stitch the end of B to the tail of C, to the end of A to the tail of B, and call the result C. Now, with these two operations, you can construct any tangle you wish. In fact, any virtual tangle you wish. Because basically, any tangle you wish, you can construct by first of all taking a disjoint union of crossings. So you put crossings in the plane in some arbitrary manner, and then you stitch their ends together using this stitching operation. So, in order to construct an invariant of tangles, or one way to construct an invariant of tangles, is to specify what the value of this invariant will be on individual crossings, and then to specify how it will behave under these two operations. And this is how I'm going to describe the Gassner invariant. So theorem, there exists a unique invariant Z defined on pure tangles with S components, so S here is a set and it's just a set of labels for the components, and it is valued in a space gamma of S, where gamma of S is the space of S by S matrices with entries in the ring of rational functions in variables corresponding in variables T sub A, where the indices A corresponds to the elements of the set S. So basically, it's an invariant with, if it's tangle, the tangle with K components, it will be an invariant in K by K matrices on in K in polynomials in K variables, sorry, rational functions in K variables. And all I have to tell you is what are the values of this invariant on the crossings, and how it behaves under the two operations. So, on an overcrossing labeled A and B, and on an undercrossing labeled A and B, the value of the invariant will be, well, it should be a matrix whose rows and columns are labeled A and B, so it will be the 2x2 matrix written right here. So one of the, so with plus sign, it's the overcrossing, with minus sign, it's the undercrossing. And I've thrown in the 1x1 matrix, which corresponds to the identity tangle, the one strand identity tangle, just for fun. Okay? And then I have to tell you how it behaves under disjoint union. So if you have the invariance of two tangles, and one tangle, the invariant is a matrix A1, for the other tangle, the invariant is a matrix A2, then the invariant of the disjoint union will simply be the block diagonal sum of the two matrices. So you just put one matrix here, one matrix there, and that's the invariant of the union. And the more interesting thing is what happens under stitching. So now, suppose I have a tangle like here, and I want to stitch strands A and B to create a strand C. The invariant of this one will be an S by S matrix that has one row and column labeled A, one row and column labeled B, and then a bunch of further rows and columns. So in other words, it will be a matrix that looks like this, where it has one column labeled A, one column labeled B, one bunch of columns labeled S, and then one row A, one row B, and then lots of other rows labeled S. S here is the set of all other rows. So in fact, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta are scalars, or more precisely, elements of that ring of rational functions. And then theta really corresponds to a whole row of things, and you can see it because it has a line in the middle, and likewise for epsilon. And phi and psi are columns because they have columns in a sort of a line in the middle. And ka and psi is like a big S by S matrix of all the rest. And now, the stitching operation acts as follows. First of all, you identify the variables TA and TB and call the result C, TC. So that's just sort of basically the variables of different components stop being different. Then you let mu be 1 minus beta, and I'm only saying it for simplicity, so 1 minus beta is 1 minus the entry over here. And then you create a matrix which is of size 1 less by applying these not so great looking formulas. So the CC entry is gamma plus alpha delta over 1 minus beta. And gamma was a scalar, alpha was a scalar, delta was a scalar, mu is a scalar, so this is a scalar. Likewise, you let the entry here be epsilon plus delta theta over mu, and if you think about it, this is a row, this is a row, the rest are scalars, so the result here is a row, and we should indeed here have a row, because it's a single entry cross a whole list of entries. Likewise, this is a column, and this is a matrix, plus a column times a row divided by a scalar, which is again a matrix, so it fits. Okay? Now, you'll have to believe me that this is an invariant of tangles, or later I could explain why it is an invariant of tangles, but anyway, here is the implementation. First of all, a few uninteresting utilities about how to format such matrices. This will be relevant when I print them. Then, here is the actual implementation. So again, I don't want you to look too much about the details, at the details, but if you look at this line, perhaps this is the key line, because in this line, you see exactly the formulas that we had before. Okay, so this is the implementation of the formulas we had before. And finally, these are the implementations, or these are the values of the overcrossing and the undercrossing, written right here. Okay? And then here's the implementation of the Gauss-Gassner formula. So, basically, the Gauss-Gassner formula with input a Gauss diagram G and at complexity K, so looking at K crossing at the time, is, again, ignore all the details, but the point is that over all subsets of the diagram G, which are of size K, so over all subsets Y of such of G, for each such subset, first of all, compute the set of cuts that corresponds to it, so that cuts the Gauss diagram in, if the subset has k elements in it, it cuts the Gauss, it, you should be cutting the Gauss diagram in 2k places, so you get a tangle with 2k plus 1 components, and then you basically compute, you repeatedly stitch the invariant according to the stitching formula which was implemented before, except not if the index where you need to stitch is a member of the set of cuts. So you skip a few of the stitchings that you would normally do, and as a result you get a 2k plus 1 by 2k plus 1 matrix, which is the invariant of the cut tangle that you get. Here is an example. Now, clearly you cannot read it, but it's in your handout, and the other thing is that you don't really want to read it. It's only an example. So let's compute the Gauss-Gessner formula corresponding to the knot 4-1 at complexity 1 and using the formula function f. Now, I've never defined the formula function f, so it remains unevaluated. So f should be evaluated on. So basically, you have to look at all subsets of size 1 of the Gauss diagram of 4-1. So these are a negative crossing from 1 to 2, a negative crossing from 2 to 1, and a positive crossing from 1 to 2, and a positive crossing from 1 to 2. If you look at the four arrows in the Gauss diagram of 4-1, that's exactly what they are. Now, if you look at the first one, so if you remove one arrow, or more precisely, cut next to one arrow of 4-1, so you cut in two, you have this long line, you cut it in two places, the result has three components, so the Gassner invariant of it should be a 3x3 matrix, and this is the 3x3 matrix that you get. Again, the precise information is not terribly interesting, the precise entries are not interesting. What's interesting is that it's a 3x3 matrix of rational functions in the three variables t1, t2, and t3, which correspond to the three components that you have left. And likewise, for the second term, the third term, and the fourth term, and here's what you would get if you were to do the same, but look at complexities both 1 and 2. So for complexity 1, you get the same as what I got before. So these are the first four terms here. But then you get further terms in each of which you look at a pair of crossings. So there are six of those, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And if you have a line and you cut it next to two arrows, meaning you put four cuts, then it becomes five pieces, so you get a 5x5 matrix. And here are the six 5x5 matrices that you get for 4-1. Now this looks awfully complicated, but from a computational complexity perspective, it's nothing. Okay? These are 5x5 matrices, it's not a big deal. Okay. Here is theorem 2. So theorem 2 is, so if you look at complexity 1, and you let the formula, the actual Gauss-Gassner formula, Fa, be defined by the following thing. So Fa, when fed with a right-going arrow with sine s, is equal to s times the following combination of the entries of the matrix gamma. And likewise, Fa fed with a left-going arrow of sine s and a matrix gamma is s times the following combination of the entries of the matrix gamma. Then the resulting Gauss-Gassner formula for this F is a regular isotopy invariant. So that should be exciting because it's a polynomial time computable, not invariant, but unfortunately it's essentially the Alexander polynomial. In fact, it's the logarithmic derivative of the Alexander polynomial. So if you look at this and subtract from it the logarithmic derivative of the Alexander polynomial, which, by the way, is equivalent in power to the Alexander polynomial. If you know the derivative of the log of something, you know that thing. So it's really equivalent in complexity to the Alexander polynomial. Okay? And the difference is an integer, and that corresponds to the ambiguity in the definition of the Alexander polynomial, which exists anyway. Okay? So here's an implementation. So Fa, well, again, maybe I should not go through the details, but these are exactly the formulas from the previous slide. And when I compute it for 4-1, I get this answer. The Alexander polynomial is this. The logarithmic derivative of the Alexander polynomial is that. If you compare this with that, the difference is an integer. You can do it by plain simplification. Here is For each of the nodes with 3 to 7 crossings, the difference between the Gauss-Gessner-Alexander formula of K and the logarithmic derivative of the Alexander of K, and you can see that for each of those nodes, it's an integer. Maybe I should not go through it, but here is the complete proof of invariance. If you want to prove that this crazy formula is an invariant, all you have to do is to feed it with the left-hand side of the Rademeister 3 move and the right-hand side of the Rademeister 3 move. To be honest, I also have to do the same for Rademeister 2, okay? So I feed it with the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the Rademeister 3 moves, but with sort of gaps left between in various places. The gaps mean that basically you can have arbitrary stuff in between where the gaps have been left, okay? And then you compute the Gauss-Gassner-Alexander formula of this Gauss diagram, and then of that Gauss diagram, you compare them. Maybe I should not discuss this line, but anyway, the output is true, and that's a proof that this really is an invariant. Okay, so my expectation, and I should explain why I think the expectation is true, but the expectation is that higher Gauss-Gessner invariants exist. In other words, I've shown you a k equals 1 example, and my expectation is that there should be k equals 2 examples as well, and everything that we did was polynomial time computable, so they should be polynomial time computable, not polynomials. Now, I should add that I can right now reach for these invariants only wearing my exoskeleton. So basically, you know, exoskeleton is these things that sort of the bad guys in various science fiction movies wear. Okay, so it's these devices that make you 10 times more stronger, but also vicious. So in my case, it's basically computer algebra. So, but it's not computer algebra, it's not sort of supercomputer power in the sense of sort of computing very, 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 very complicated things. It's just computer algebra doing the mundane algebra of the kinds that we've done so far, okay? Which is kind of within reach for humans, but humans would want to keep away from it, okay? Now, I should also say that I expect these higher Gauss-Gassner invariants to be the higher diagonals in the Melvin-Morton-Rosansky expansion of the Kollar-Jones polynomial, and since I'm running out of time, maybe I should not remind you what this is, but I should say only two things. One is, well, if you know other ways to compute these higher diagonals, go ahead and use them, if they're polynomial time. Okay, I mean, I have my way, but there might be better ways, and I challenge you to find them. And the second point is that, you know, so you'd say, so all that Dror is computing is a section of the Kollar-Jones polynomial. We're sick and tired of it. We know it all too well. But I want to argue that it's actually more important than the Kollar-Jones polynomial, because the Kollar-Jones polynomial is effectively impossible to compute. And if I'm telling you that there is a certain polynomial hiding inside it, which is reasonably easy to compute, you should be jumping up and down. Okay? It's much more valuable than this great big Kollar-Jones polynomial as a whole. Okay. Why do I believe that such Gauss-Gassner formulas exist, and how do I intend to find them? And I really do intend to find them. I'm not faking it. I will find them sooner or later. Okay? So, how much time do I have? About 1 minute. So, but this calculates the actual time, I'm afraid. There's a timer up there at the top right. Okay. Well, you know, if you want me to talk another 10 minutes, I can. That's not a problem. But anyway, the point is that so the Gauss-Gessner, the Gauss-Gessner-Alexander formula, which I displayed, is in fact a reduction, or is about a certain invariant of Gauss diagrams in a space of arrow diagrams. And it's the kind of space that arises in finite type theory. So you should be thinking of these as analogs of chord diagrams, except it's the chord diagrams that arise in the WK, so they have arrows on them. So it's basically, well, it's a slightly different situation of finite type theory. And the invariant is defined by mapping every arrow in the Gauss diagram to an exponential of arrows in this AW space. And this AW space, as I said, is a space of arrow diagrams, but modulo a few relations. The few relations are tails of arrows commute. There is a relation for how to commute heads of arrows. And there is a certain 4T relation. And the details of how all of this is done is, this is heavily studied in papers by myself and Juji Tancho, and by myself alone. Now, so the real question becomes, so how do you compute such a big product of exponentials? And the answer is, well, you should be thinking in general, in non-commutative algebra, how do you compute a product of exponentials? How do you understand the product of exponentials? The answer is, the best answer, so there is an answer from hell, and it is to use the BCH formula. And if you ever try to work with the BCH formula, you know why it's an answer from hell. It's really hard. The better answer is to differentiate. If you differentiate, basically, each exponential, so now each arrow here stands for an exponential, and each exponential contributes an extra, the internal derivative at the top of the exponential. So you get a red arrows that stand for these internal derivatives, whatever that means. And then, so basically, sort of the original product of exponential sort of glows. Every exponential in it produces a certain red glow, and you want to compute the total glow. Except, in order to compute it, you first have to scatter the red pieces outside of the of the mess, of the black mess. You have to sort of view it from outside, like, you know, you're looking into the nuclear reactor from the outside, and you see the glow of the radioactivity of the material inside as scattered by the water that surrounds it. Okay? So you have to compute how to scatter red out of black. And again, without going through details, the scattering of red out of black is precisely given by these Gassner formulas. So that's what the Gassner matrices do. They scatter red out of the red out of these messy formulas. And then the real key point is to replace tails commute by a slight deformation of it. So instead of having tails commute, you replace it by, instead of the right-hand side equals zero, you replace it by epsilon times something, where this something itself squared to zero. So basically, you end up running the same scattering process, where you scatter red out, except, and it scatters in the same way, so you get the same Gassner formulas, except one time, something might happen differently. And exactly one time, because when it happens one time, you get a factor of epsilon, and if it happens a second time, you get zero, because epsilon squared is equal to zero. So when you scatter red out, it scatters out by the same formulas, except you might have one additional contribution from attempting to scatter this red out of yet another crossing. And that gives you formulas that depend on two crossings instead of just one. And after that, it's again normal Gassner scattering. and I am 4.5 minutes over time. You should have stopped me a lot earlier, and I'll stop here, and you know, one day I will complete this story. Yeah. Is this what you always had in mind?
It took you only 16 years. That's my comment.
Okay.
And I will expand when I talk to you directly.
Okay.
No more questions?
No, we have 13 years left.
I think pictures after your talk, so it's the most important part.
Okay.
So if no more questions, we have to, I don't know, we have less.